The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Oh, Great Spirit, earth on sky and sea, you are inside me and all around me. Oh, Great Spirit, earth on sky and sea, you are inside me and all around me.
Alafia, Bomatum, welcome. Seneco Kakona, multiple blessings to everyone. Daka Taino Borinquen. I am Taino from the indigenous nation of Borinquen. My Spanish name is Virginia Perez Sanchez. I am also called Aina Lode in the Yoruba tradition and Siba E in the Taino tradition. In this sense, I live and represent the three lineages, the three mothers, las tres madres. It serves as a great honor to participate in this Free Library of Philadelphia event for the launching of the book of My Broken Language, a book written by my daughter, Kiara Alegria Hudis. And to witness my beloved daughters, Kiara Alegria and Gabriela Serena from Power Street Theater, continue our women ancestors' cultural lineage of storytelling. It is a way of getting themselves into the circle of life with others. For we women of color are subject to unwillingly accept and adapt to the changing ways in which our truths will be told, posing a challenge to our survival and also to new generations and entire communities. Kiara Alegria has done a very well job in upholding our treasures, preserving the many oral histories passed on to me by my ancestors as a way to validate their existence and struggles, and by finding new ways in our lineage to search and to discover her own truths. Kiara has shown courage, being valiant enough to share our circle with others, linking the past, the present, and the future with hope. For me, the love for a book can run deep. Growing up as a child in the town of Arecibo, Puerto Rico, the only place we would be allowed to hang out as a child was the public library in my barrio. It became a refuge well into teenage years, and I remember the old heavy leather-bound books written in Spanish. They had a special musky scent and thick paper pages. One day I arrived to find all books had been removed and replaced with new books in a foreign language. I felt devastated, as if losing the greatest of friends. After migrating from Borinquen to Philadelphia, we had to adapt to a different environment, no longer the soil, the sun, or the sea. But we had an extended family sense in a vibrant Spanish-speaking neighborhood that no longer exists. Its location was 19th and Calo Hill, right behind the main free library, where once again, I will find my refuge and discover new friends. Being of indigenous lineage, my parents and those before them were very well acquainted with the erosion of their personal history. So to prevent further cultural loss, they rely in sharing all stories. Telling our stories is part of the Boricua culture. We sing our stories while hitting the drums to the sounds of bomba and plena. We using singing the to stories aloud and dance with great passion to immortalize events. It is part of our language expression. Mataron a Elena, mataron a Elena, mataron a Elena y se la llevaron pa'l hospital. In the Caribbean African Yoruba Lukumi tradition, we have the Patakis and the Orikis. The Patakis are the stories from African ancestry, and the Orikis are the songs and invocations that are sung with the drums to connect us with the divine outside and within. Eni ala yo koju de wole titi la je chango bakoso kabio sile chango. Some of us see the drums as a beating heart, lit with fire, giving pace, moving rhythm, and spouting forth a language based in our experience and events that hold importance and power. And so are the books. They are the beating hearts that unite with our own, bringing forth life, experiences, knowledge, and wisdom. Now as an elder, I see Kiara Alegría, the woman, as a valiant scribe who has sealed our language of rhythms with words, with passion and feeling, and unapologetically raw. With her ancestors' blessings, she's endowed with a gift of honestly telling our stories and gifting them into the future for generations to come. I hope that you can enjoy her memoir and learning the language of body, feelings, and land, of finding and embracing ourselves through the pain, of discovering the sorrows and the laughters, never feeling shame for humble beginnings with their hidden treasures and power of greatness. Tainoti. I appreciate you and I love you. Hang hang katu, so it be. Ache. Thank you.
Wow. What a way to start.
What a way to start.
Yeah. So, I feel full. I feel very full.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, in a way, this amazing opening and blessing that your mother gave you and us gives me one of the answers to the first question that I had for you tonight, which is, you know, I always think of memoirs as something that people write when they reach an age where they're wearing granny panties and they sit in front of their fire because the bar is open too late and they can't drink anymore. And, you know, sex is, well, it's not what it used to be. And so you're sitting in front of your fire and you're, well, I might as well write my memoir. Whereas you are in the midst of this vibrant life, constantly making new circles. And so I wanted to ask, you know, the question I'm about to ask, I'm going to give one of the answers. I realize how amazing and important it is that you wrote My Broken Language while your mother is here and with us, and connects the lineage all the way back. That directness that we are blessed with is a wonderful reason not to wait 30 or 40 years. But for you personally, why was this the time for you to look back?
Well, I'm 43, and, you know, I'm like shaking. That invocation was so powerful, and I'm here in the presence of my mother Virginia Sanchez, who introduced me, and you, Paula Vogel, for anyone who's here who doesn't know our relationship. We're not just women of letters who are in that community, but you were my teacher. You opened a door for me and you walked alongside me on a path for a few years and you guided my footsteps. And that was a gift in and of itself, let alone for our to stay friends and to stay close and to stay family. So I'm very overwhelmed right now. And I think that what you're talking about, I hadn't even thought that. Like, I have to tell this while she's alive. I had thought I have to tell, write this book while the girls in the family are still young.
Yes.
Because for me, there was an urgency about saying, here's some information about how our family got to where we are. Here is some of the accomplishments we carry in terms of how we migrate through life, how we migrate from island to continent. Here is some of the suffering we carry that maybe has not been voiced. Here is some of the shame we carry that has been put on us. And now in the telling, can we move to the next chapter, which is, are we ready to relinquish some of the shame? Are we ready to, by understanding and naming some of the suffering, to heal? And the other thing I do is I say, here is also how we celebrate. And that has been a key to our survival thus far. So let's get that down in writing, so that we don't take for granted that future generations just are born knowing this. No, let's codify that. Let's tell that. Right. And the benefit of having my mom still around, yes, but really the book benefited from it because she read drafts and, you know, my writing career has, part of it is earning trust and writing out of family stories. It can be dangerous. You know, I'm writing out of insensitive places. I'm writing in wounds and in vulnerability. And so I think having that earned trust behind me, having earned my mom's trust, so she would read drafts and say, oh, there's this whole part of the history you don't know yet. Or, yeah. You know, she had added a lot of insight there.
Right. You know, it's so interesting, just the way your mother started this evening. I was thinking, well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And it's like making this wonderful pearl necklace of Perez and Sanchez storytellers, you know, linked back. But for me, from my point of view, you know, the reason that I wanted you to come to Brown was to teach me, to be my teacher. And I think of the time that we had together there as a chapter in my learning, that I never saw theater or plays the same way. I didn't see language the same way. And one of the things that I think is so significant for me is that as playwrights, we don't really get to be visible and in command. Everything is done. We're almost puppeteers behind the scenes, making the sets move and the characters move, but we don't get to represent ourselves. And it's actually a very important time for particularly writers of color and women writers to represent themselves, because we are always being defined, whether it's by the critic or the eyes of others, to be able to say, no, I want you to look at the story through this lens, will completely give, I think, a more intimate way of looking at all the amazing plays you've written. Because, and going forward, you have made yourself, given yourself a visibility that will continue to resonate through the plays and the movies and the next memoir, you know, the next children's book that you write, the next musical. By the way, what are you thinking of next? I shouldn't ask this because I know This is like steering a huge ship right now of launching my broken language.
Well, I'm launching a few things that I've spent many years working on, this book, and then next the In the Heights movie, which I adapted for the screen.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a time of launch. You know, Paula, something you said resonates a lot about, you said that I taught you, and it's in my book. Listen, you were the funnest, you and Pop were the two funnest characters to write, because there's so little to do. It's purely description. It's just the character is so full of life. The person is so full of life, so colorful. And it's a scene in the book. My phone rings, I answer the phone, I hear your voice, which is memorable. And because there's something kind of mischievous and frisky in your voice, that, you know, it's, can I speak with Kiara? Did I say that right? I remember you asked about the pronunciation immediately, which was not so common then. And you had pronounced it right, which was impressive. And I was floored that it was Paula Vogel on the phone. And then you said, come teach me, come to Brown and teach me. So I put that scene in the book because I was really floored, and I didn't even have the vocabulary in that initial conversation. Like I wrote in the book, you said, how did come teach me what you do? And I didn't have much of a response because I couldn't articulate what I did at that point. I was like an instinct player still. I wasn't totally self-aware. I was on a path to self-awareness. But the notion of teaching being circular and being intergenerational is wonderfully freeing. I don't think it contradicts the notion of respecting one's elders. I think it's an inclusive notion that says, you know, Gabby's born when I'm 13, and this is my sister. She becomes my teacher. And boy, in the final chapter of the book, when I have a real revelation, you know, that's because the child has taught me.
Right. Right. And one of the things that I don't know if I've ever said this to your mother, but I'm so grateful when I get to learn from someone else's child that they've raised and I haven't. You know, I feel like I get to be the recipient of all of this powerful, amazing parenting going on. And it's not to say that I think parents create artists, but I think parents give permission for their children to be artists. Parents give permission for their children to tell stories of their own. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, from my side of our conversation as we were driving around in my brand new Honda, from my view of the conversation, my heart was beating because I was like, what if she turns me down? I mean, one of the things that I think is remarkable about my broken language is that it also says, you know, white university English, white literary English is not the only language in this country. Mm-hmm. And the academy can suppress a lot of languages. Mm. I was very aware with my own experience that it had to be reversed. And so when I planned a workshop, I was thinking all of the amazing voices that would teach me, that would teach each other. And I still think, and I think of this in terms of my broken language, I think of you as a teacher. I think great artists are. That ability to get past your fear, to be this intimate on the page and remember and go back and look at how you were feeling, but also bringing in your adult self, which has now been taught by your own children, that has been taught in your relationship with Ray, the boy. And to give me all of those filters is, I think, a generous act of teaching. And I think it's actually a time where this is desperately needed. And this is the next question, I guess, I want to ask you, which is, I feel that this book shows a way to speak back to a kind of white supremacy in this country that has been unleashed and that has cast aspersions on the energy and the heart blood of the country, which is immigrants. And how do you stand up, resist, celebrate, survive, but basically say, hey folks, I'm here and you're here and we are going to see this through to the end of this hideous time. So, I mean, was that sort of playing in your mind, the divide that we're feeling as a country? Because you were actively writing the book then.
It was a very conscious choice in some regards. I mean, first of all, that work on the book for me starts within because, you know, I'm bicultural, I'm biracial. You know, I'm half white, so I carry, this isn't just something that is put on me. This is something I carry within me. This is, you know, I experienced it firsthand, the privilege of my skin growing up. And I experienced it most clearly and consistently in contrast to how I was treated right alongside my elders who had darker skin than me. It's wild to be a five-year-old kid in, you know, the antique store or a five-year-old kid in the grocery store or in the King of Prussia Mall and to be treated with far more respect than your mother who is an elder, you know? So yeah. that has been, that has wrestled deeply in my heart and gut. And honestly, the book gave me it gave me a process to be really much more specific and rigorous about that, how I was looking at times that I did hold my tongue when I was around what I consider racist ideas or unfair ideas, microaggressions. There were so many times I was silent. There were so many times I held my tongue. And at the most extreme of those times, I was so angry with myself and hated myself so much. So there's a decision at some point to which is, no, writing is going to be an act of breaking that silence. Yes. You know, my mom helps me make that decision. She said, you know, you were always a writer. Why did you never pursue it? And boom, is like the door came open for me. I hadn't seen it, but she was right. I had been writing all my life. The other decision though, is to write the book, My Broken Language. I'm going to show its pretty cover because
it is a beautiful cover.
It's all the women, and then there's some spirits here because the spirits enter into my story and into the book. And part of the decision is to write these women not from a pure vantage point of being defensive, not write them against white supremacy, but create a space where, no, this is who we are on our own terms, not in relation to you, not in relation to, you know, people who don't understand. Create a space where we just are who we are too. And so I wanted both of those spaces to really, I wanted to address, you know, white supremacy and racism, but I also wanted to close the door on it and say, but we're in the living room now, so let's just be us. So that's why I, you know, there's one of my favorite chapters is the dance party at my abuela's house on July 4th, because it's just the women are moving their bodies so beautifully the way they dance. And I'm just a shy kid on the steps watching and in awe. And that was us living life on our own terms. That was us surviving pain through exuberance and dancing and celebration and party. So it was both of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I have to say that I can't think of many, playwrights who have written such intoxicating women characters. I mean, the characters cast almost a spell on me when I watch one of your plays, when an actress or an actor, actually, I don't use the actress word anymore, inhabits that body with her own body. there's something that happens on that stage. You know, I'm thinking of the amazing Daphne in Miss You Like Hell, and how much she gave that role. I could not take my eyes off of her. She made me laugh. There was no resistance. But I think that that is because, in a way, you shut the door and say, this is our space. This is what's happening in our space, which is actually still very, that's radical in the American theater at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century. So I actually feel that the way that you have these characters define themselves, show themselves. Now, there is perhaps the tragedy of it is that it collides with the world that sees the characters as other at times, which is when my heart is wrenched from my body. But I also want to say that I feel that every single play you write shifts. So one of the things I want to ask, because I also think that the reason that your voice is unique and extraordinary is that you are using your composer side and your music and that language that you spoke for so many years, which also had that same divide, that you were in essence talking back and forth between the two sides in your music. But what's remarkable is you've taken the music now, and that is part of the language of your writing. It's in my broken language too. There's tempo and rhythm in this book.
Yeah. Did I cut you off there?
No, you didn't.
It's my earliest memories. You know, I remember when my Aunt Linda in New York, you know, she stacked the two phone books on top of the piano bench. Because I was so small, this would have been me playing piano. So she had to went back in the day when there were yellow pages. I think some people attending this event might remember such a thing. She stacked them up and she put on a record. It was Champion Jack Dupree. And she said, just play along. And she closed the door and left. And, I was chasing the notes. I was listening, and it's blues changes. So the chord changes follow a pattern. Yeah. And I started hearing the pattern. I started finding the notes that go. And I think that started me up. For the rest of my life, I was chasing the notes. As you could hear from my mom, she was playing beautiful music out of our liturgical traditions, out of the Afro-Boricua traditions, Afro-Caribbean traditions, the Lukumi. Plus there was just so much street music around me. You know, there was Adimu on the street corner. I believe I mentioned him in the book. He would take trash and he would transform it into, he would make like a kalimba, like a thumb piano out of an old Bustelo can. So he was always transforming trash. And then when we got off the trolley from school, he'd be on the corner and he'd say, all right, kids, come on. I got a new one. You're going to follow me, watch what I do, and then you'll all take your turn. And he would teach us to play his trash instruments. And then he would sometimes make us listen to music on the boombox. So, you know, that's how I first heard the song Bobby McFerrin Stars that he did with Yo-Yo Ma. And his boombox was always like running out of batteries almost. So we had to like lean in really close and listen. And, you know, I'm chasing the music all my life. And then after graduating, I study music in college. And then after graduating, I'm performing with real professional musicians. And this guy, Larry Gold, these are all stories in the book. This is the story of my path as an artist. So Larry Gold is a big producer in Philly. And he's like, okay, let's cut an album. Let's think about this. And after a few tracks of that, he just says, you know, kid, you're not good enough. And, you know, usually in my life, I gotta be honest, I don't take criticism that well. But I didn't think he was criticizing me. I actually heard it and I thought he's being accurate. And I don't think I was diminishing myself. I really heard what he was saying.
Yeah.
And I said, what am I doing? What, you know, what if he's right? But there's something about the music that is very true and that I have mastered in my heart and soul. And I think it was the thrust, the rhythm, the different genres, how music tells stories, how music is vocal and has voice and personality. And so, yeah, it was very helpful when my mom then says, I was weeping when I wrote this scene, and I didn't weep when the experience actually happened. It was a very quiet experience. So when I wrote it, you know, I was weeping when she said, you know, you really got into this music thing and I respect that and you've done so well, but why did you never write? And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, like, Boricua women don't write. What are you talking about? I don't even know. I have no like model or picture of what you're talking about. She's like, you always were a writer. So she tipped my path, and that's when we get to then I'm applying to Brown, and I'm you know, meeting you.
Oh, I vividly remember. And again, it's so interesting. I think we have very fragile, delicate skins as artists when we're young and we enter a room with other artists. But when you entered the room, I could feel everybody else suddenly feeling very thin-skinned in that you had this voice. You always had this voice. You weren't filtering your voice by saying, okay, what is it that August Wilson wrote? Or what is it Irene Fornes wrote? Or do you know what I mean? Oftentimes we find ourselves through an imitation, but you were forming yourself by melding the experiences, the different languages you spoke, where you were in this moment in time, and something came out. Now, you know, they're both paths to finding our voice as writers, but I always felt with you, the voice led. And that was very clear to everybody in the room.
You know, it's funny because one of the things I talk about in the book a lot is basically my continuing like bafflement and confusion at life, which sounds critical and sounds like it has a negative connotation, but I'm just saying it descriptively. Like, I would witness my mom's spiritual genius and I was confused. I didn't have that spiritual gift, but I was fascinated and it piqued my curiosity and I wanted to know more. I wanted to go deeper about an experience that I didn't totally understand. Same with my cousins when they danced. Like I was confused because they were so fully embodied as young women. I was the youngest cousin, so my cousins are older. They're embodied head to toe. They are dancing with every inch of themselves in a way that is only particular to them. They're not doing steps.
Right.
They are feeling and moving. Yeah. And I had already, I think, long reached a point in my life where I was disembodied and was connecting to things kind of from here up to, you know, to cite how I learned to drive.
Right.
Your beautiful play. And there was so much input. I didn't understand, why is my Puerto Rican life here? Why is my white life over there? You know, why is one parent telling me about how the dead came to her, even from being a child? And the other parent is saying, I don't, you know, God doesn't really exist. It was so much input. And all of it was fascinating to me. And then I think when I decide to be a writer, all of a sudden there's clarity. I don't know how to do it. That's why I applied to school, because I was like, I don't know how to do this. But there was a why, like the why was just very simple and calm and clear for me. And I still have that. And people are like, you know, when are you going to stop writing? Like, when will you be done? And I'm like, as soon as the why goes away, then I'll be done. But it's still here. It's burning. It's bright.
That makes me very happy. Something else I just want to say that I really loved and I found liberating for me as a woman reading your book. And that is the acceptance of the body. that I feel that you are wending your way from living up here.
Yes.
Watching the dance and then gradually coming to a recognition that bodies are beautiful. All bodies are beautiful. And to be given that, like I said, you're my teacher. I mean, there's something where I have felt that I had utter shame and disembodiment about my body when I was a young woman and I had a body. I was ashamed of it. Now I'm a Bubba.
Yes.
The force of gravity is on my body and I have no shame anymore. And reading your book, I was like, wait a moment, but that's cool too. You know, it's just such a gift. And again, I become aware of how much I feel that we let ourselves be censored or policed by the eyes of others. Well, so that was a gift.
I mean, I have to, okay. So I have to jump in here because this is one of the reasons I wrote the book. Is I'm interested in creating a space because I have been in such spaces where women's bodies aren't policed and are actually natural, exuberant, and miraculous. Right. And so I would push back a teeny bit and say I didn't discover that all bodies were beautiful. I knew that. Somehow the programs from society didn't totally affect me. The discovery was, how does my body move in space? So some of the ways I witnessed these bodies kind of being miraculous and beautiful was, you know, seeing my mother in spirit possession. That was shocking and extraordinary. I mean, her whole body transformed. It looked like her body was honestly like denser. It looked physically and materially transformed. Seeing the dance. One of my favorite things I've ever written is the beginning of the last chapter of this book, because at my abuela's house, there was a lot of women in the family, not a lot of men around. And so there were a lot of people staying there always, like people would be showering, people would be getting dressed, and everyone's walking around naked, like especially upstairs where the shower is, getting dressed. So I'm seeing very large bodies with big pouchy bellies. I'm seeing very skinny bodies. I'm seeing a lot of cellulite. I'm seeing the scars from the C-sections. And these things are thick, man. They're not like my petite little lovely scar that I have. And it's not people are covering themselves up, you know, to run and get, they're just parading down the hall. Like this is how it's meant to be. And they're saying, look at it. They're jiggling the nalgas and saying, look at, check out my cellulite. You know, they're proud and they're showing off and they're being specific. All the bodies look different. And so they're pointing out, well, here's how mine is different from yours. And I was a kid, this was very natural to me. I learned by middle school, oh shoot, the rest of the world don't think this, you know, and a lot of other women's spaces that I went into. No, it's like cover up, suck in your belly. You know, there's a way for the body to be. It was Kate Moss times. It was like, don't hate me because I'm beautiful sort of vibe and heroin chic and all that stuff. Yeah. And I love it, but I don't experience it. And then with a few exceptions, and those are four moments I write about in the book where I'm writing and something happens to me. Right. And all of a sudden it's like this dam I had built up breaks and I'm so embodied I totally lose control. And I wonder during those moments of writing, one was an essay test at Central High School, another one was standing at Quaker Meeting, so I wasn't writing physically but I was storytelling, and then the last one happens at Brown. Well, the last two happened at Brown, and I'd never had those experiences again. That's why the book plot-wise ends where it ends, because it's these four times when I became so embodied. It was terrifying. It was like painful and deeply physically uncomfortable, and it was amazing. And so the writing actually set my body free.
Oh, that's powerful. Before we open up to the audience, speaking of the gifts of the body, I want to do a shout out to Power Street Theater and to say to Gabby, it's so wonderful for me to be virtually under your roof with the co-sponsoring, and just how great this is. that in one virtual space, your family is here. That's tremendous. And did you want to?
So we asked, Power Street Theater is a wonderful theater company in Philadelphia, run by and founded by my sister, Gabriela Sanchez, and playwright Erlina Ortiz, who's a very gifted writer. And we asked the Power Street community, what languages do you speak? Because in my book, every chapter is titled a different language that I speak. And so here's some of my favorites. We got a lot of responses and they were all really beautiful. So forgive me, there's a lot of gorgeous ones I'm not reading, but Michelle Wilson on my Twitter, she said that she speaks English, Ebonics, Love, Baby, and Feline. On my Twitter, Violeta lists a lot of languages, but she does mention that conversational Star Wars is one of them. Claire Freeman, which was on my Twitter, she said hers include, she lists a bunch and then she says hers include a smattering of neurodiversity, but I would never presume to know enough to speak it. So I was interested in that because it's like, right, there's so many languages that we kind of know, but that we kind of keep those cards close to our chest because we don't feel comfortable giving them voice necessarily. And then this one is from Capo de Gram on Power Street Theater's Instagram. I'm just going to read their whole response. Their languages are English and ASL. Having been raised by two deaf parents on the East Coast, I'm considered a child of deaf adults, CODA. I grew up fluent in both English and American Sign Language, ASL, with ASL being my first language at 5 months old before I could even speak. So thank you to the Power Street audience and friends for joining me in that conversation. And the other shout out we wanted to give before we go into Q&A is to Philadelphia Young Playwrights. These are organizations that, you know, really helped me, you know, that they saved me in a certain way. They chose my play, they gave it respectful feedback, and they produced it. My play called My Dreams About Girls when I was in 10th grade. Then my boyfriend at the time, who became my husband, I saw his play reading and I was like, oh, he wrote a play, he's very fine. You know, so they kind of saved me. I was having a little crisis of confidence, and then they did some matchmaking too. And also shout out to the Free Library of Philadelphia, because that was a place of real refuge and sanctuary for me.
It's wonderful. Well, we have some shout outs here from the audience, and some are in the form of questions. This is from Liz Morales. What was the most joyful and most difficult part of the book for you to write, and why?
The most joyful was absolutely the describing the women's bodies in my family. And in particular, I probably shouldn't curse on this public forum, so swear word warning, if there's any children listening, mute for a second, please. But it was talking about, like, there was so much pubic hair, you could upholster a fucking mansion. I almost, like, that was the ultimate mic drop for me. I was like, that's the world I want to live in. So that was the joyous. It was just joyous to bear witness to all that beauty, not because it met any standard of beauty, but because it was natural and it was accepted and embodied. The hardest part, there were a lot of hard parts, but one that came to mind right now is, you know, I write about my tia Rosa, and Titi Ginny was my closest aunt on that side. I was close with all the aunts, but Titi Ginny and I were like this, and tia Rosa and I weren't quite as close. She was older and therefore like more powerful. She was also a very powerful, strong woman. And remembering her, that was some of the hardest writing I did, remembering how like I was so intimidated by her power, but very drawn to it too. And there's a memory where she's playing bingo. She was an extremely aggressive bingo player and she had very good luck. And I come and she has, you know, it's like you always have to get blessed by your elder. So I'm weaving through the very crowded dance party and everyone's sweating and stinking. And she just, she was a large woman, a very large woman. She had these meaty, meaty, hot hands. And she just puts my hand in hers and holds it there as she's blessing me. And I don't know why, like, and I wanted to pull away because it was too intimate, but I also wanted to stay there and be blessed forever. And remembering the feeling of wanting to pull away when she's no longer with us,
yeah,
that, you know, that, I was sad to remember that, wanting to pull away.
But also incredibly truthful. I mean, that to me is what creates the intimacy, the courage to be truthful. Someone has asked, what does the title mean, My Broken Language?
So I talk about in the book how many languages I inherit, and English is my mother tongue. It's my native language, which is the same as my dad, but it's different than my mom. And so because of my mother's cultural and spiritual life that I'm sharing with her as her daughter, English doesn't have, it's my best language, but it doesn't have sufficient vocabulary to describe myself or my world and to communicate it to other people. So I get confused and I feel between languages. I talk about how it's like, it's presumes that, you know, my father is the one who made me good at language because he's a native English speaker and he was an avid reader and he taught me to read very young. And so yes, absolutely to that. But to rediscover through writing this book that actually, like, my mom had to earn English in a way that neither dad nor I ever had to. She had to earn it. We were born into it. She had to earn it, just like immigrants earn their Americanness in a way that native born people here never have to. And so I'm like, I love my mom's broken English. I love it. You know, I love her accent. And then I get to, and I'm always struggling with Spanish. Like, you know, I'm always like, oh, I'm always translating to English in my head and struggling with that with my family. And then I get to Brown and Paula, my teacher, says to me, well, your Spanish is broken. Write your broken Spanish. And having permission to make something creative and artistic out of something broken, having permission to do that, I mean, I was like, I hit the ground running. Say no more. I'm on it. I shall do that, Ms. Vogel.
See, I feel, and partly this is because I was taught by Nilo Cruz that being articulate and being giving expression are entirely two different things. It's one thing to be articulate in a language, it's something else to break it and make it your own.
Yeah. And you gave the example at Brown. You gave the example of, you know, Shakespeare. Yeah, and I put it in my book. Shakespeare, you know, loved the English language so much that he broke it over and over and over again. And all of his breakings, you know, the Oxford English Dictionary grew by 1,000 entries. He's the original breaker, okay?
He is the original breaker. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, there are two questions here that I want to kind of combine. And one comes from Linda. Rick asks, you create a lot of memorable fictional characters in your plays. What are the differences and or challenges in writing about real people? And then you speak about characters. This is from, I'm not sure how to pronounce your name, Miss Cullinan. You speak about characters in your memoir, but they are real people in your life. Is there an important distinction to make when you wrote this? In other words, what's the difference between your creation of character in a play and writing about people that exist?
I think the reason I still think of the people that populate this book as real people, but also as characters. And one of the reasons why is because this book is about a very particular, it's not an autobiography, it's not the history of my life. It's one particular story of my life, which is the story of the matrilineal descendants of Obdulia Perez, who's my grandmother. that's a really particular lens. And in fact, so I'm curating, I could write a whole different book about my mom and her pursuit of antiques. I'm not kidding. I don't even mention that she goes to antiquing here. Same with my dad. Same, I do mention his woodworking and how that was a reverie for me. But I could write a whole different book about, you know, how he taught me in the backyard, how he taught me to read. Same, there's so many people in here that I could write a different facet of them. And so the facet of them is what feels like a character, because it's not comprehensive. It's not saying this is everything I was, this is everything Gabby was, this is everything Tia Rosa or Titi Ginny was. No, it's being a little bit more selective for this particular story. The thing that I've always written inspired by people, and it's just what some of it's called fiction because I make up events and plots and stuff, but this is nonfiction. The main difference was writing about myself. And I think when I'm writing about other people, I feel a responsibility to be careful. I get terrified. Whether it's a fictional play or this book, I get terrified to share it. With myself, I didn't feel the need to be as careful. And so I tried to give myself a harder time. I couldn't say whether I accomplished it. I think I would not be a fair judge of that, but that's what I attempted to do.
These are great. Another question is, do you think your memoir will affect how you write plays or how your plays are received in the future? Does my broken language create a new context in which to hear your plays?
Wow, I don't know. I can't wait to find out the answer if I ever get to. I live in the moment so much as a writer. Like I don't feel that I carry all of my plays with me right now, because the act of creating it and then completing it, it also creates closure of the need to live in that space and create it. So I don't know. I think actually maybe outside readers are better suited to answer that question, but I will say, this outlines a spirituality that has been much more subtle in my stage works, and it outlines a point of view about womanhood that has not been as explicit in my stage works. And so that might be a cool way to reflect back on the plays.
Yeah. You've got a lot of fans writing here, Kiara. I'm just telling you.
Really? I can't even see the feed, but cool. Hi, fans.
I don't know that we'll have time for all of them, but there's someone who just said, your children's book was the most important book I read each year, several times a year, in my bilingual kindergarten classroom in Fairhill for many years. You captured their life experience so perfectly. Will you write another children's book?
One of the other projects I'm working on right now, I wrote an animated feature with Lin-Manuel. That's called Vivo. It's for children, but it's also for adults. It's a whole family film. And so, you know, maybe that counts. I don't have plans to write another children's book, but that's only because I don't have the idea yet. If it comes to me, I'm writing it.
Great. Seriously, you're getting questions here about all of the genres that you write. Here's something from Hi Kiara. I was involved in the recent production of Water by the Spoonful at Webster Conservatory. I've been really inspired by you to start writing, but I feel so paralyzed about how to start. Do you have any advice?
One is to please be patient in terms of where we are in this pandemic. I think it's actually a very difficult time to seek inspiration. For me, writing involves a strange mix of being utterly directionless and embracing that, and then having focus. And I think it's very hard in what feels like a very directionless moment in history to give yourself space to be more directionless. It's quite challenging. My ideas on how to start would be to basically, like, give yourself a dare. This is a technique I learned from Paula, give yourself, and if you could find one other friend who might be willing to take this risk with you, like dare, okay, we'll each write, I don't know what genre you're writing, let's say it's poetry. Okay, dare, we'll each write 3 poems by next Friday. We'll get together, we'll read them out loud or Zoom together, and we'll eat slices of pizza at the same time. So basically give yourself an accountability buddy, and you're not critiquing. This is not critiquing, this is just saying, well, I don't wanna write my poems, but I would be disappointing someone else. It would be unfair to that other person if I don't. So it kind of tricks you into doing it as a social pact.
Would you please talk about getting the differences and the cadences of your two languages right on the page?
You know, there's this weird notion, and I don't know if it's just something I've internalized and put on myself more, or if it actually does exist out there as much as I feel like it does, this notion that an artist has an authentic voice, right? That is something, it makes me nuts, and it's something I've struggled with a lot, because I'm like, an authentic voice, but what about Whitman? What about multitudes? Like how... If one has multitudes, which hello, like I've got all the check boxes and a few other fill in the blanks, you know, what is one authentic voice? Why can't I have 20 authentic voices? And then as they kind of form alliances, new ones sprout from them, you know, I was really nervous and curious about an experiment in this book, which is, does every chapter have to flow in the same way? Do I have to use English in the same way in every chapter? And I kind of was like, no. So there's some chapters that I think feel very familiar, like childhood memoir, a kind of familiar narrative vibe. And then there's some that's just like me ranting. You know, the chapter on my mom's accent, I just go off and I just like ranting. There's a chapter, one of the themes I talk about is illiteracy. And my own burgeoning love for literature as I discover some of my elders who do not read and are not capable of reading. And so there's a chapter that's very meditative where I, with very few words, kind of contrast, you know, well, what would my life be if I hadn't read Beloved? What would my life be if I hadn't read The House on Mango Street? You know, and so there's these, so, you know, I honestly, I forget the question now, but I, no,
but the I whole thing it? About getting the cadences on the page, and, you know, it's interesting. I may slightly disagree here in that I don't think we ever know what our own voice is. I think it's impossible to know. And I think that just that voice itself, like a person, has so many facets, you can never encapsulate them all.
Yeah.
I also think that voice perpetually evolves itself by the last work the writer wrote. And because of that last work, the voice has changed. But it's the way that people who love you say, oh, that's Kiara. Mm-hmm. You can't see that. But people who know you, love you, even when I try to surprise people, they're saying, oh, that's Paula. You know, even when I try to, and I think that that's true. I think you have multiple viewpoints and that you're constantly experimenting or challenging, daring yourself. But I actually think that, you know, at the sum of all the works you'll ever write, we will know a spirit. We will know the spirit, the voice that is Kiara. I don't mean to be contrary. One last, if we may, is this okay?
Yeah, let's do one last, yeah.
I just want to say here, this is a comment. No questions, just humbled to have met Kiara through her Aunt Linda. I've followed your career from Central High School. The introduction was so powerful. Love to life. Amazing to see your mother. It's Vanessa from Philly and the Big Apple Circus.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, you know, the Big Apple Circus, like, it's barely mentioned in the book. That's a whole nother memoir. And I'm a different character. I'm a very different character in that one, you know, with different language in that one. And that's one I'd like to write one day. Vanessa was amazing. I've seen her do handstands on top of elephants' heads, by the way. Like, this woman is ferocious.
Linda says, all the ancestors love you, Kiara. What would be, this is a great question, what would be the most important thing you would want your daughter and the future Perez generation to take with them from your book?
I think actually the very detailed histories that are in it, you know, to know that we do have a history. It is important in this nation's history. You know, our story matters, our history matters. We were part of these important historical moments. You know, there's an entire narrative thread about how I experienced AIDS and addiction in the 80s and 90s, devastating my family. You know, these are things that they might not know about if we don't write. We didn't know it at the time. We didn't know what it was at the time. It's disorienting to be living through history. You don't know what it is. But now, decades out, I can look back and see this is what was happening nationwide, you know? So I want them to honestly, like, take the histories and the importance of writing those specific histories and hey, pick up the torch and, you know, write the next chapter, write the next book.
I think that may be a beautiful, beautiful place to end this with thanks to Kiara for the book. Thanks to the Free Library and Power Street Theater. Thank you, Virginia, for the beautiful blessings.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Paula. The library says that you can order signed books from them. So, or through, they put on a link for ordering signed books. So this has been a very, very special night. I'm still shaking from Mom's introduction and just from sharing space again with you, Paula, which is always a blessing. So I hope everyone had a good evening. Thank you for coming and have a beautiful night.
Please read this book. Everyone have a great night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.